Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast with Anne Fairpo, brought to you in association with CCH, part of Wolters Kluwer, number one in tax and accounting worldwide.
Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast for December the 10th. Apologies for any slightly weird sounds and so on. I'm having to do this on unusual equipment, but bear with me. This is the Edinburgh edition of sorts anyway. What it certainly is the Autumn Statement Roundup edition. It's probably inevitable, really. Also going to cover off a case on intergroup debt, whether it is or isn't a loan relationship, and government action on avoidance and evasion. So coming back to the first one, the Autumn Statement Roundup. As I say, this is fairly inevitable at this time of year. This was just, however, the Autumn Statement, not the budget. That said, there was quite a bit going on one way and another. I'm going to ignore the economic doom and gloom to focus on the tax stuff. There's a limited amount of time for this whole podcast. More stuff will undoubtedly come in the draft finance bill that's being published tomorrow, December the 11th. And that'll include things like the above-the-line credit proposals for large company R&D. First off, corporation tax rate is coming down to 21% in 2014. I'm refusing to take any bets on whether it'll wind up matching the small company's rate of 20% at some point in the near future, but that's clearly where it's heading, and a 1% difference does make it more and more pointless to try and calculate the marginal rate. The annual investment allowance is being tinkered with again. It's beginning to resemble a yo-yo. 50,000, 100,000, 25,000, 250,000, 25,000. It's very generous, George, but it's ultimately meaningless for most small businesses. Perhaps farmers might find it useful. But other businesses, you know, 90-odd percent of businesses don't spend 25,000 in a year, let alone 250. The tenfold increase, to quote the Chancellor, will be in place for 2 years from the 1st of January 2013, so more hybrid rates to think about. A very unlucky company would have to work out its capital allowances through a month of 100,000, 9 months of 25,000, 2 months of 250,000, with all the usual limitations and confusions. It's been confirmed that some sort of cash basis income tax regime for small unincorporated businesses will operate for 2013-14 onwards. Such small businesses will also not have to distinguish between revenue and capital expenditure, according to the revenue. Sounds potentially useful, but I want to see the fine print. Is HMRC really giving up deferred deductions from 28% tax, or 10% with entrepreneurs relief, to allow immediate deductions at up to 45%? In addition, unincorporated businesses will be able to choose to deduct certain expenses on a flat rate basis. The details remain to be seen, presumably on the 11th, but this looks like an intriguing variation on the US-style standardised deductions that effectively allow you to take a fixed deduction without having to keep specific evidence of the expenditure. In addition, from the Autumn Statement, the employee owner status looks like it's full steam ahead, with some possible quirks and changes to it. George Osborne has accepted that it may not be appropriate to make employees pay income tax on shares they've been given when they've also given up employment rights in respect of those shares. But it is still going ahead despite copious objections from all sorts of sources. And you know, the sorts of issues that are being raised are, well, how are you going to value the shares? Isn't this going to simply replace employment status and employment disputes with share valuation disputes? And other issues along the lines of, well, how do you really know it's worth 2,000? I mean, one suggestion was that they're deemed to be worth 2,000. Well, frankly, if I'm giving up my employment rights, I'd want to know things were worth 2,000, not just have them deemed to be worth 2,000. Anyway, various business-related measures have also been introduced to reduce avoidance, in particular property return swaps, tax mismatch schemes using loans and derivatives, manufactured payments, and income tax deductions for non-trade payments of patent royalties have all been given their marching orders as of the 5th of December. For individuals, the main news was that the personal allowance will increase to £9,440 per annum. The basic rate limit will not rise as much, and the increase in the higher rate threshold in the next couple of years will be capped at 1% as well. Most allowances, in fact, look like they're going to be dragging well behind inflation, so they fall in real terms while still looking like they're going up. Pensions relief is being hit somewhat again. The annual allowance has been reduced from £50,000 to £40,000, and the lifetime allowance comes down from £1.5 million to £1.25 million. Legislation for all this is coming in the draft finance bill being published tomorrow and will come through with effect apparently from Finance Act 2013. So watch this space. Moving on from the annual statement, there's been a recent case in the Court of Appeal. The case is called MJ Media Services, and it's upheld the decision in both lower courts, that's the first tier and the upper tribunal, that an intragroup debt in this case didn't arise from money lending transactions, and so it couldn't be a loan relationship. Case reference is 2012 ECWA CIV, that's CIV 1558. Case related to various intragroup transactions which the companies said were cash statements. They were evidenced only in the ledger accounts and audit trails. There was nothing in the bank statements to suggest the cash had actually moved hands at all. And eventually all the payments added up to something just under 7 million. This was January 2004. The companies then put in place a loan agreement stating the payments were a loan and would be subject to interest. A few months later, May 2004, the company signed a deed of waiver, waiving almost everything except the interest. As a partial waiver, a tax deduction was supposed to be available for the company waiving the debt. HMRC weren't particularly keen on allowing the deduction in this case, and the First Tier Tribunal agreed with them. They rejected the claim for a deduction by the company on the grounds there was no real evidence of any payments. The accounts entries just weren't enough to show that there had been a loan. Just because something was listed as a loan in the accounts, they said it didn't actually make the transactions ones that are for the lending of money. The upper tribunal was equally unimpressed. Court of Appeal was no more impressed, frankly. None of the witnesses had any direct knowledge of the transactions. Now, that has to be inevitable. More than 8 years passed since they took place, and there was no reason to upset the decisions of the lower courts, they said. The debt isn't a loan relationship, there's no tax deduction for the waiver. Now, if there's a moral to all this, it's that groups must be clear when putting loans in place, with clear documentation, preferably contemporaneous, and all of that will be of a huge help to anyone discussing the matter with HMRC, and will certainly be a help to the barrister if it ever has to go to tribunal. Where loans arise because of something other than a straight cash payment shown on bank statements, documents are even more critical. So this would be the scenario where a loan arises because one company pays off the debt of another to a third party, for example. That sort of thing, it really has to be very, very clear what's going on and why it's going on. In another area, slightly related to the autumn statement, the small government action on avoidance and evasion, closing loopholes, and some action out of the European Union as well. As part of the overview of spending, the government is actually going to provide another £77 million to HMRC and isn't cutting staffing, or at least not for now. The money is supposed to be focused on anti-avoidance and evasion activity by wealthy individuals and multinationals. For multinationals, the money is supposed to identify and challenge transfer pricing arrangements and strengthen their ability to do risk assessment across the large business sector. I do have to say, it would be nice if they would put some of it into training on the local level as well. We see an increasing number of transfer pricing inquiries coming from the local offices, usually relating to small businesses that are undertaking transactions with non-treaty countries. If you remember, the transfer pricing exemption for small businesses or small companies only applies where the company is transacting with a company or another enterprise in a jurisdiction where the UK has a tax treaty that has a non-discrimination article. If we don't have a tax treaty, or we do and it doesn't have the non-discrimination article, the small company isn't entitled to transfer pricing exemption in the UK. And the local business offices do seem to be picking this up. It would actually be quite helpful sometimes if the local inspectors actually understood properly what they were doing with transfer pricing. It's also interesting that for the last few years, the transfer pricing unit at Business International has been trumpeting the reduction in transfer pricing inquiries. We've had all sorts of press release about, 700 cases when they came into effect, and 12 months later they only had 350 live, and that they've reduced the number that they open so that they can focus on the high-risk ones. I mean, it's all well and good that they're providing additional money to them, but it'd be useful if HMRC would maintain some level of consistency as to what it is and isn't addressing. I mean, presumably the £77 million is to go towards the high-risk, high-value issues, but that's not been fully explained. The affluence unit is going to get another 100 investigators and some additional staff to look at offshore evasion and avoidance of inheritance tax through offshore means. Apparently the agents and tax intermediaries are the ones in the firing line there. Offshore evasion in particular is getting a good long look taken at it, and not before time, with a new team to look at how to use data to identify offshore tax evasion, to review HMRC's legal powers and work with other administrations, and also to beef up the technology side of things. including the increased use of third-party data. As I've suspected for some time, HMRC are looking at credit reports and so on for information, which isn't surprising. I mean, it's there, it's available to them, why wouldn't they use it? If they're using it to go after evasion, then all well and good. I'm happy about that. COP9 has been updated, by the way. That's mostly minor changes with an updated flowchart for the decision tree. So if you've got any clients who are heading in that direction by the looks of it, I'd have a look at that. The European Union is also getting in on the avoidance and anti-evasion, or anti-avoidance, anti-evasion action. It's adopted two recommendations for EU responses to evasion and avoidance. Firstly, member states should identify tax havens and draw up national blacklists. I'm pretty sure most of them do this already, at least informally. Perhaps the idea is to get them to coordinate it a little bit better. Secondly, and more interestingly, they should reinforce double tax conventions against aggressive tax planning and adopt a common general anti-abuse rule. A European GAR is not something I'm holding my breath waiting for, but the reinforcement of double tax conventions against aggressive tax planning could be interesting. Which conventions? The ones within the EU or the ones from the EU out? And what definition of aggressive are we planning to use for a start? A tax authority definition or the press mob definition we've seen in the UK recently? On which note, to come on to the snippets, I'm afraid I'm going to start with a bit of a rant. I am getting fed up with the continuing and willful, in my opinion, failure to understand either tax law or the relative issues at the level of the press or apparently the Public Accounts Committee. Avoidance is, according to HMRC, 4.5 billion of the tax gap of 32 billion. That is 14%. Yes, it's quite a bit. But evasion, that's crime and the black economy, accounts for almost 15 billion, 46%. Simple non-payment accounts for 4 billion, that's another 14% as well. These figures come from the HMRC Tax Evasion Report 2011. It's not from some Pollyanna tax apologist. They make it clear we'd be much better served if the Public Accounts Committee and the press made some attempt to go after those sectors, the ones that are actually evading tax, illegally getting around the tax system, and people who are just flatly not paying stuff they know they owe, and not just going after the soft touch of a high street retailer, particularly a high street retailer that had an effective global tax rate of over 32% the first 9 months of 2012. This is Starbucks we're talking about, unsurprisingly. If it's avoiding tax as a company, as a group, it's doing so incredibly badly. In fact, it'd be better off moving profit to the UK at those rates. Ben Saunders, who tweets as Ben Saunders CTA, points out in his blog that if Starbucks were gaming the system, they'd be at break-even in the UK. Their current arrangements give a tax charge in the Netherlands and Switzerland without a current matching tax reduction in the UK. They're sufficiently loss-making that deductions for royalties, etc. are just additional losses, not reductions in profits. It's particularly irritating these stories paid HMRC and UK tax laws so little favours. They seem to think they're completely toothless. But on Starbucks royalties alone, HMRC disputed the transfer pricing so that Starbucks now deducted 4.7% for royal tax purposes and not the 6% of the accounts. Transfer pricing isn't just something that companies do. It's an internationally agreed set of tax principles that are aimed at ensuring that companies can't simply shift profits around as they choose. Other articles have completely ignored FIN capitalization rules, suggesting that Starbucks is 100% financed by debt from the USA. Actually, never mind the thin cap rules, where does anybody get the idea from that paying interest from the UK to the USA is a tax-saving scheme? The UK corporation tax rate is 24%, the US federal rate is 35%. Paying tax from the UK to the USA is an increase in tax of 11%, ignoring state taxes. It's not a tax-saving. They'd be better off as a group not paying interest to the US parent, but you can pretty much guarantee that the IRS would be deeply unhappy about that, to put it mildly. If it's an arm's length rate, and transfer pricing rules require that it is, does it matter if a company pays interest to a bank or to its parent? It's still getting the same deduction for tax purposes. Those who are making the argument that subsidiaries shouldn't pay for the use of their parent company's intellectual property should acquaint themselves with the inflows to the UK of things like the inflows to GlaxoSmithKline and similar UK businesses before they decide such payments are immoral. Or are they only immoral when the payment leaves the UK? Finally, I'd love to congratulate the BBC journalist who did eventually accept that plain vanilla loss relief is not controversial tax planning, but we'd have all been better served if the facts had been checked before the story went out. I'm annoyed because we need a discussion on tax in this country. It's long overdue. We've got a ridiculously long tax code because we bolt on bits here and there, and nobody really stops to sit down and say, what are we trying to achieve with the tax system? Is it simply a money-raising thing? Are we trying to manipulate behaviour? If we're trying to do all of this and we're trying to respond to international, how should we go about it? And yes, we need that, but this isn't what we're getting. This isn't a discussion. It's a one-sided excoriation of non-UK businesses, fuelled by misunderstandings and misrepresentation, without any obvious intention to listen to the facts. It's the antics of a bully bull pulpit. In the meantime, those who are actually breaking the law and evading tax are just laughing as a steamroller passes them by. Anyway, I'll calm down a little bit, but only a little bit. Individuals in management and financial roles in the gambling industry have to be regulated. They have to have a license to be employed, and it's illegal to be involved in the receipt of money for gambling or marketing gambling without such a license. Seriously, why is that regulated, but anyone can call themselves an accountant or a tax advisor? This fee has now been added to the list of qualifying professional fees and subscriptions in Section 343 ITEPA. See, there was a point in putting this into a tax podcast. It's now deductible from earnings for tax purposes. I'll probably get you on the blacklist as undertaking immoral tax avoidance. But anyway, this covers the fee to acquire the licence and fees to vary the licence and for the 5-year maintenance checks. On a mildly random point following on, HMRC have changed their view on capital allowances for polytunnels. They now accept that some such structures may qualify for plant and machinery allowances. Companies that have had claims rejected for polytunnels should have a look at Customs and Excise, or sorry, Revenue and Customs Brief 3221012 to see whether they should apply to have the claim reconsidered. In particular, where a polytunnel is used to protect crops growing in the ground, and it has to be moved from time to time because there's a limit to how often you can grow the same crop in the same soil, then it may well be plant for qualifying plant machinery purposes. For example, raspberries have to be moved every 5 years, so polytunnels for raspberries growing in the ground would be qualifying. If the polytunnels are used to shelter livestock or to cover plants grown in containers and don't need to be moved, they're likely to be treated as fixed structures. The same will apparently be likely to apply where the polytunnels are used to protect crops, which could be grown in the same place for a decade or more, such as blackberries. I would say this all looks a bit like a tribunal case waiting to happen. Different tax treatment for two identical polytunnels, one used for raspberries but the other used for blackberries. Seems like an invitation to dispute to me. Nevertheless, if you or a client are in the raspberry category, get a claim in. And lastly, as I'm in Edinburgh, I mentioned some time ago the Scottish Land and Buildings Transaction Tax. Now we have a call for evidence on this tax. It gets the obligatory anti-Westminster dig in, refers to collecting taxes better and at less cost than the UK government, and setting out an innovative approach to taxation, which is apparently to be progressive rather than slab. I think you'll find there are progressive taxes in other areas. Anyway, the call is for mortgage tax, land and housing bodies to submit their views along with the general public on the bill. On which note, have a good week. Enjoy reading the draft finance bill when it comes out tomorrow, and I will speak to you next week.